This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Astounding new science finds the amount of land and people exposed to sea level rise has been wildly underestimated. At least 100 million more people will be flooded out this century. And a lot of that new seawater is coming from melting ice at the poles. Professor Jonathan Bamber is a specialist in the Great Ice Melt, providing data used by scientists around the world. Dr. Bamber is from the Bristol Glaciology Center at UK's University of Bristol. We reached Jonathan Bamber in Toulouse, France. Jonathan, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me to speak on the program.
Well, your work is critical when trying to understand how radically coastlines will change for this generation and the next. But first, let's talk about this astounding new paper in Nature Communications titled New Elevation Data Triples Estimates of Global Vulnerability to Sea Level Rise and Coastal Flooding. And of course, that is not news for you. What did you get from the lead author, Scott Culp's presentation at the annual meeting of the American Geophysical Union last year?
Well, I saw the title of the talk in the program, and I thought, well, that's a must-go-to session. I've done a lot of work with something called digital elevation models. That's land surface topography, mainly derived from satellite data, but sometimes from ground-based data as well. It's a very interesting study. What they've done is looked at the most commonly used digital elevation model for determining global land surface elevations, and it's a model called SRTM, which is the Shuttle Radar Topographic Mission, and it was flown about 15 years ago or something like that, and it's one of the most commonly used data. It's not the only one, but it's the one that is used by many groups to assess the vulnerability of coastal communities to sea level rise and coastal flooding and other natural hazards in coastal areas. And they looked at the accuracy of SRTM in coastal areas and produced a new DEM that they've called Coastal DEM, which improves the representation in coastal areas. But in essence, there's a bias in SRTM, a high bias. In other words, in coastal areas, SRTM is giving you elevations that are typically a few meters too high. And they've corrected that bias, more or less. You know, I mean, you know, there are inaccuracies in all global data sets, but they've certainly reduced the bias and reduced the random error, the sort of, you know, the what's called the standard deviation, the random errors in the DEM. And by doing that, they discovered that, or one of the conclusions of their study was that it's around about three times more people are going to be exposed to coastal flooding than was predicted using the SRTM DEM. That's the kind of headline of that study.
It sounds to me like the NASA's shuttle radar data was accepting things like treetop levels in forests and building tops in urban areas as though that was ground level. Is that correct?
Well, look, I mean, we've known that for a long time because one of the uses for digital elevation models is to define watersheds and to determine where water is going to flow in, not in coastal areas, but in inland areas. And so if you look at somewhere like Amazon Forest, well, SRTM is actually of limited value there because it's just measuring the canopy top elevation, not what's called the bare earth elevation. And obviously in urban areas or heavily vegetated areas, particularly like rainforests, SRTM doesn't penetrate the surface or buildings, and it doesn't measure what's called the bare earth elevation. So we have known that, but I guess it's been quite a challenge to improve on that product. And it's not everywhere that you get a bias. I mean, obviously, if you have some very open coastal area with low-lying vegetation and no urban development, then the bias is likely to be quite low.
You know, what surprises me too, though, is that apparently we in the public and policymakers didn't know that this error that's known in scientific circles was happening. And now it sort of comes to us as a big shock. Well, you mean you didn't know what the actual elevation of the land was in so many key areas?
Well, look, I mean, that's the scientific process. I mean, we're constantly, you know, improving on our understanding and knowledge of all parts of the Earth system and, you know, everything that's going on. You know, I mean, Voyager 2's just gone outside of the solar system, hasn't it? You know, I mean, everything is, we're constantly improving our understanding and, you know, chipping away at some of the uncertainties. And, yeah, we understood that there are uncertainties at SRTM. What they have done in this study is they've quantified them and they've shown that there is really quite a significant bias in particular coastal areas and areas where there's heavy urban development and lots of vegetation. And they have quantified the effect of that on the impacts on populations. I think that's the kind of the big advance that they've done in this study, which, you know, does, as I say, it increases the number of people that they are expected to be at risk of, let's say, annual flood events or that are going to lie below the mean high water tide level by about a factor of 3, which is quite a big difference. So in the study that we did, which I think we're going to talk about a little bit later, we had an estimate for the number of people that we thought would be affected or potentially displaced by a 2-meter sea level rise, and the value we came up with, which came from the literature prior to this study, was 190 million people. Well, that is now, according to this study, more like 600 million. And to put that in perspective, 600 million, that is the 1/10 of the population of the planet right now, or roughly. You know, that's a lot of people. It's twice the population of the U.S.
Yeah, now, not all those people are going to have to just run away from where they are. I mean, they're talking about annual flood events are possible at the start of things, and I think people will adapt somewhat, but it's still pretty shocking that the ocean is going to start flooding into so many people's lives in this century.
You're absolutely right. I think we should be clear that we're not saying that 600 million people are going to have to leave their homes, you know, straight away, but if you think that your house is going to be flooded like once a year, that's, you know, that's not going to be very pleasant. It's not going to be much fun. It's going to make life fairly difficult. And in addition, I mean, there will be communities that will have to move inland. They'll have to migrate from coastal areas because they'll become uninhabitable. One of the consequences of sea level rise is what's called salinification. So that is basically the intrusion of salt water into freshwater groundwater in coastal areas. Once that happens, and once you don't have a natural freshwater supply in a coastal area, well, then, you know, it becomes very difficult to continue living there. So, I mean, there will be migration inland. There will be people that are displaced, but it's not 600 million, for example.
Well, even when we do get a better estimate of what land is really within 2 meters or about 6 feet of the current sea level, we need to know how much that sea level will change and by when, and that is where your work contributes a lot. How much of coming sea level rise will come from the melting ice world, the cryosphere?
Look, that's the $64 million question, which we'd all like to answer in one way or another. And I don't think we've got that long. I could spend several hours trying to explain, you know, give you an answer to that question. There are various different ways we can tackle that question. There are several factors that influence sea level rise, and there are three that are sort of very important. There's one which is thermal expansion of the ocean. So when the ocean warms, it expands, sea level goes up. And that's something that we understand pretty well. And there are uncertainties around how much heat will be absorbed by the ocean over the next century, but those uncertainties are not so great. So we have a pretty good handle on thermal expansion, okay? And that, you know, it's going to be on the order of 20 to 30 centimeters or of that order. It depends on the climate warming scenario, the trajectory we follow. But, you know, we've got a fairly good handle on that. The second component is melting of glaciers, mountain glaciers around the world. So that's all the ice outside of Antarctica and Greenland. Now, if you melted all of the glaciers, that's like all the glaciers in the Rockies, the Andes, the Himalayas, in the Arctic outside of Greenland, everything, that would contribute about 45 centimeters to sea level. Now, it's not all going to disappear by 2100, but maybe in a what we call a business as usual type scenario, maybe half of that, about 20 centimeters, will come from glaciers around the world. The third component is the ice sheets. Now, the ice sheets contain 99.5% of all the ice on the planet. If you melted Antarctica and Greenland tomorrow and you dumped them in the ocean, you'd raise global sea level by 65 meters. Now, to people in the U.S., that's, over 200 feet. So the ice sheets have the potential to have a really big impact on sea level rise over the next century. But the problem with the ice sheets is that they're actually not particularly well understood. Their response to climate change and to changes in what we call external forcing, in other words, like what the oceans do and what the atmosphere does, are not that well understood. We have models of ice sheets which are relatively sophisticated, but they don't include certain important processes, and there is a debate about what processes are important and what aren't, and so there's a large uncertainty surrounding what the ice sheets are going to do over the next century, or actually next few centuries. So rather than take a modeling approach, what we did was a method, an approach called structured expert judgment. I guess I should explain a little bit what that is.
What is that?
Yeah. It's a method that's been used, if I sort of introduce it, a method that's been used very extensively for assessing the risks and the uncertainties surrounding what are called low probability, high impact events. So the examples of those are that there's about, I think, is it sort of 50 or 60,000 people that live on the island of Montserrat. In the center of Montserrat is a volcano, an active volcano. So it's absolutely critical for those people living there to have some handle on what the likelihood of an eruption is in the next few days, you know, so you can assess whether you need to evacuate those people. So volcanic eruptions, earthquakes, the risk of things like what's called rad waste, radioactive waste leakage, dam failures, all of these sorts of things that are actually, we have some understanding about what processes influence these things. You know, we know something about mechanics of volcanoes and earthquakes, but the models are not adequate for giving you predictions. And that's the position we're in with ice sheets. And so what you do is you take as many of the sort of world-leading experts that have published or have an understanding of this particular field. You bring them together, and we organize two workshops, one in the U.S. and one in Europe. You go through a series of questions which you know the answer to, but they don't. And that's what's called the sort of calibration phase. That's the structured bit to the expert judgment. So what we're doing by asking these questions is determining the expert's ability to assess their own uncertainty in something. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. And so this is a process that can be applied to climate change and particularly to things like sea level rise, for example. Now, in 2013, you and W.P. Aspinall published a paper that used expert judgment assessment, and you said in that paper that you suggested a conceivable risk of sea level rise of greater than a meter by 2100, but your latest on the subject, published in April 2019 in PNAS, says, quote, "Our findings support the use of scenarios of 21st century global total sea level rise exceeding 2 meters for planning purposes." Why did you go from talking about 1 meter to 2 meters in just 6 years?
Yeah, that is a very good question. And the first thing I should say is those numbers are not mine. I didn't generate them. They came from this structured expert judgment exercise where we pool the expertise of the world's leading experts. In the most recent exercise, it's about 23 people from North America and Europe, where we pulled their expertise and we asked them what they think their best judgments. It's not a guess, it's a judgment of what they think the ice sheets are going to do. And why have the numbers changed? Why have they effectively doubled? There have been some studies in the last 5 or 6 years that have suggested, that imply that in particular the Antarctic ice sheet is more vulnerable to warming, is could respond faster than we previously believed, in essence. There was an influential paper published in 2016 by two US scientists, Rob DeConta and Dave Pollard, where they introduced a mechanism called the marine ice cliff instability. Now, the details don't matter, but what they found was that by introducing this mechanism, which is theoretically entirely reasonable. You know, from theory, it totally makes sense. It just hasn't really been observed in the present-day ice sheets. By including it, they were able to reproduce past ice sheet sort of changes in volume during previous warm periods, in particular a period called the Pliocene, about 3.5 million years ago. And including this marine ice cliff instability mechanism in their model made, in particular, the East Antarctic much more sensitive to climate warming than we than models had suggested previously. And I think part of the higher numbers that we're coming up with now is due to the experts' belief that this is a plausible mechanism. And one thing I should stress about the numbers that you quoted, the 1 meter and the 2 meter, those are not what we call the most likely scenario. They're not the mean or the median estimates from the experts. They're the upper tails, the 5% probability, what some policymakers might call the worst case scenario. You know, the relatively low probability, I mean, not that low, it's a 1 in 20 probability, low probability, high impact. But what is indicated from our analysis is that mechanism has made the experts feel that the Antarctic ice sheet could potentially contribute more than we previously believed to sea level rise. And I think there's a second factor that has quite strongly influenced expert judgment in the last 6 years, which is that our observations of the ice sheets, and that's an area that I've worked in quite a bit over the last few years, are quite short. They're only about the sort of high quality observations from satellites are only 25 to 30 years long in terms of the length of the record. And that's quite short in terms of a climate record. It's quite short to determine whether you're seeing a trend or just natural variability in the system. But when you look at that record, mass loss from West Antarctica and from Greenland has roughly been steadily increasing over time. And many of the models of West Antarctica and Greenland haven't really predicted that behavior. And so, again, I think what that's suggesting to the experts is that actually, in particular, Greenland and West Antarctica are a bit more sensitive to climate forcing than we previously thought. And I think if you combine those two factors together, it's given the experts the sort of the view, the judgment that both ice sheets, well, all three, there's Greenland and then Antarctica is usually split into West Antarctica and East Antarctica, that all three of them are more sensitive to climate change than we thought, say, back in 2012 when we did the previous study.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock, your nonprofit program on climate and the environment. I am Alex Smith. My guest is Professor Jonathan Bamber from the University of Bristol. We're talking about the great melting ice world and seas rising around hundreds of millions of people. So I guess the Climate Central study on the millions exposed to sea level rise looks at several scenarios, and the worst combines continued high emissions as now with what they call Antarctic instability. And I guess that's what you were just talking about, the Antarctic instability?
It's exactly that, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, the acronym is MICI, Marine Ice Cliff Instability, which was, I mean, proposed a while back, but the first kind of really important paper on it was published in 2016, so that's quite recent.
Jonathan, you work on calculating ice loss from places like Greenland, and a group of scientists, including James Hansen and Andrew Glickson, are watching that cold blob of meltwater collecting south of Greenland. Do you think an onslaught of colder fresh water from the glaciers could change ocean currents or even the weather in places like your home in the UK?
Okay, so that again is an area that we in my group have worked on quite a bit. And the technical term, or the term oceanographers use, is the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, the AMOC. And there have been quite a lot of studies looking at whether the strength of the AMOC, which releases a lot of heat in the polar North Atlantic just south of Greenland and keeps Northwest Europe much warmer than it would be without it, whether that could be shut down or whether it could be weakened by lots of melt from the Greenland ice sheet. And I think the jury is still out on that one. I think the latest evidence, I mean, we published a paper about 3 years ago on this, is that it looks like the Greenland ice sheet in the next decades could have some impact on the AMOC. It seems unlikely that it's going to shut down, that you're going to have a, you know, something like the sort of day after tomorrow type scenario where, you know, suddenly, I don't know, the Hudson River freezes over or whatever it was that they had in that film. The evidence right now suggests that you're not going to have a very dramatic, what we call in jargon, a tipping point in the climate system. But there does seem to be some reasonably compelling evidence to suggest that the AMOC could weaken as a consequence of increased freshwater fluxes from Greenland, Arctic ice caps, and also from the rapidly melting Arctic sea ice as well, which is putting fresh water back into the Arctic Ocean and North Atlantic.
The other really strange thing to me, Jonathan Bamber, is that as the ice is lost from these continents and they lose mass, which you measure even from satellite measurements, then the sea level rise right around Greenland and Antarctica might actually go down. Is that true?
Yeah, that is a bit of an odd one. You know, I'm a professor in a university, so I teach undergraduates, and one of my favorite topics is this. It's called self-gravitation, and because it's really counterintuitive, and I think, you know, the students, once they get it, they find it really sort of just incredible that this sort of thing happens. But so the sea, the surface of the sea follows something called the geoid, the shape of the geoid. The geoid is just the gravity field around the Earth. So the surface of the ocean is not entirely flat. It goes up and down over long distances, depending on how much mass is underneath the ocean or how the gravity field of the Earth changes as a function of location, because it's not constant. You know, where you have a lot more mass, the gravity is a little bit stronger, and you get water being pulled towards that area. And so it accumulates, it sort of piles up in areas of stronger gravity. Where the gravity field gets weaker, then the opposite happens. Now, if you take a load of ice, and we're talking, I mean, huge volumes of ice, at the minute, the Greenland ice sheet is losing something like 280 to 300 gigatons of ice. A gigaton is 10 to the 9 tons. 1 gigaton is a cubic kilometer of ice.
Is that annually?
Annually. And so it's losing, let's say, around about 300 cubic kilometers of ice a year. You know, huge, that's a huge mass. So if you take that off the land and you stick it in the ocean, then the gravity field over Greenland itself actually goes down, gets weaker. And so the water, instead of piling up around Greenland, is sort of does the opposite. It sinks. And so you're absolutely right. What you originally said is that sea level will go down close to Greenland. And what's called in the far field, thousands of kilometers away from Greenland, it actually goes up by more than the sort of global mean as a consequence. So it's quite a counterintuitive process. There's another really wacky thing that happens as well. You know, the Earth is spinning on its axis, and if you take that the mass off Greenland and you stick it in the ocean, then based on this principle or law, which is conservation of angular momentum, then the axis of rotation of the Earth to change to conserve angular momentum. Does that make sense?
Not totally yet.
Yeah, well, okay. Do you know what a gyroscope is?
Yes.
Yeah. So if you have a little gyroscope spinning on a table and it's spinning round and it stays upright because of the wheel that's spinning round, which is weighted. Now, if you get a piece of gum and you stick that gum not on the axis of rotation, but you stick it on the side of the gyroscope a little bit, let's say two-thirds of the way down, then the gyroscope is going to tilt over towards where that gum is, because you've changed the distribution of mass on the gyroscope. And to conserve this angular momentum, the rotating momentum, the axis of rotation, you know, your spinning point, needs to change. I mean, the other example is, you know, if you take a bicycle wheel and you spin it round, and then you put your finger on the end, it, you know, it tips down. It's exactly the same thing. And we're talking, I mean, very small changes in the angle of rotation of the Earth, but they're large enough to be measured by accurate geodetic instruments and to actually change the distribution of water in the longitudinal east-west direction.
On the larger scale, I am hearing rumbles from august German scientists and institutions that the current scientific method and the political system for handling climate change is not working. Just this week, IPCC stalwart Dr. Robert Watson is reporting the Paris Agreement will not slow down global warming. So on a personal level, Jonathan Bamber, is it time to freak out about climate change?
That's a difficult question to answer. I would say, in a way, no. I think we should have freaked out about climate change 30 years ago, personally. We're very late to the table on this one. You know, in the last 30 years, over half of the CO2 emissions since the Industrial Revolution have been emitted. So, I mean, that's done and dusted. You know, we can't go back in time. But I think, absolutely, we should have been, and to be fair, many scientists, including people like Jim Hance and actually a number of other eminent scientists in the US, have been shouting out about this message since the 1980s. I don't know. Something seems to have happened in the last year or so. I think a number of different things and factors have come into it. But the public and the politicians sort of really do seem to be getting the message now. So we're having an election in the UK, as I think you probably know, on the 12th of December, so just like a few weeks away now. And one of the major election manifesto items by the Labour Party is related to climate change, because they think it matters to the public. Now, that's the first time that that's been really high on the agenda, you know, right at the top of the agenda in the UK. And I should say in Germany, issues around the environment are seem to be number one in terms of political choices. So I think we are starting to get a message, but crikey, we really need to crack on because time is very short.
We have been speaking with ice expert Jonathan Bamber. He is a professor at the University of Bristol, UK, and a source of authoritative papers on the disappearing ice world on planet Earth. And to find out more, you can use links to the science we just talked about and some of the media coverage in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Thank you for generously sharing your time with us, Jonathan.
My pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Please pass this program on to others. You can find easy play buttons in the blog for each program at ecoshock.org or listen on SoundCloud. Retweet my show tweet. Reading short news accounts is one thing or a few seconds on TV, but hearing the scientists at the source, it's another. That's one thing we do here at Radio EcoShock.